This is Gus Sauter. Just addressing two of the topics previously discussed. The first one about signing the audit report. I think that's a fine idea, maybe with a little F, not a capital F. As Lynn pointed out earlier, the lead auditor already has the financial liability associated with putting their signature on there anyways. But you do have to ask yourself, well, why wouldn't they sign it? That would be fine. To me, a bigger issue is really ensuring no conflict of interests. That there is an inherent conflict, I think, if you're trying to be the watchdog over somebody who happens to be paying you. And so I think that it's important that the board actually gets a policy statement from an auditor as to what types of clients they will hire, and that they've established a culture that will enforce that policy statement so that they're really maintaining an independence from those from the company that they're auditing.
Well, I think that's a very helpful suggestion, and after today's meeting, we're going to have to figure out what the follow-up is. Clearly, one follow-up issue would be, from my perspective, how do we deal with conflicts of interest? And so, you know, maybe we'll chat with you, toss that back at your lap, and if you can come back with some specific recommendations, you know, dealing with how do we deal with conflicts, I think that would be appreciated. Tony?
Yeah, I just wanted to just very briefly comment. Since both of these comments have to do with the fact that I also, while running my consulting firm, have been a member of the faculty at some very good schools for a little more than 16 years. So I did a little bit of work on empirical research, and I can't say that I've ever changed my mind and the opinion about the accuracy of CompuStat. I think it's non-existent. I don't rely on any studies that say anything about stuff that's coming to CompuStat. I'm sorry? Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention was about university rankings. I've never seen anything more farcical than MBA rankings. I don't think I'm overstating it. There are two very simple things. One, how many schools do people who vote on those things attend? Do you get an MBA from more than one school? Why are these things considered comparative? The other point is, at one of the universities that I went to, I was there for about 2 years. The first year that I was there, the school fell from the top 10 ranking to number 12. The dean called the statistics department and said, I want you guys to sit down and in one day come up with everything that's wrong with the way these rankings are calculated. And they wrote a letter. The next year, they went back into the top 10, and the head of the statistics department asked the same dean, would you like me to write another letter this year?
I just wanted to thank Commissioner Walter, who has to leave at the moment. We very much appreciate your being here. It's important to us.
It was lovely to be here with all of you, and I hope to see you all again soon.
Tony, I'm sorry, we got you.
If you promise not to tell, they laugh about me and call me an accounting group.
Stay that way. Ann?
Just very quickly, I wanted to echo support for the audit partner signature. Bob, you spoke earlier about the power of the CEO and CFO certification, and I think it's the same in this space. I think it would make a huge difference in terms of having that signature. I wanted to make a few comments about the need for audited financials. We debated this quite extensively at the Treasury Department about whether they should be public or not. At a minimum, I don't see how the PCAOB can do its job, frankly, without seeing them. And frankly, I think audit committees should also have them. I think it should be part of the required communications, at the very least, provided from the audit firm to the audit committees. At a minimum, there should be at least some form of a truncated annual report that's available to the public. I think at least some financial information should be included. I think information about the firm's governance, the affiliate structure, a lot of the items that were discussed by prior folks, and also the audit quality indicators. And I guess I'd like to leave that issue at your doorstep. I mean, we discussed that quite a bit again at the Treasury Department, and as you might remember from the report, we're not very specific. We sort of said, let the PCAOB decide what those are, because we didn't really have great ideas about what those, what are the perfect audit quality indicators. But I would urge the PCAOB to really think about that, because ultimately that's what's most important, I think, for financial statement users.
Mike.
I know a lot of people have said the same thing, but I do think the audit quality indicators are one of the more important things in this category, because of how that will be reacted to by the firms. And then my last thought, which I always hate throwing out ideas that seem somewhat impractical, but I feel like I need to throw one out, because one of the inherent problems that has been alluded is that the auditing firms, even though we went a long way with independence and reporting to the audit committee, and technically the audit committee is hiring with shareholders ratifying the firms, the funds that are paying and their client still tends to be the company. And without turning it into a regulatory environment, is there a vision at some point in time where there would be a fee assessment of the publicly traded companies to create a pool, and an organization like the PCAOB actually hiring the firms to perform the audits of the financial statements? And that feels so radical a statement to me, it's hard for me to say it. But you won't ever get true independence and true clear delineation of who's the boss and whose rules are they going to follow till you follow, as they say, when you follow the money, that's where, and the money's still coming from the corporations. So there's an inherent problem that we're trying to mitigate here, even though I'm not a big proponent of fee assessment and managing that whole process. It's an idea.
Mike, you're now a wanted man. Bob?
Thanks, Steve. Bob Tirola. I just want to thank Ann Yeager for explaining all the things that she thinks ought to be done, because I agree with her 100%. But I want to add two personal notes to that. One is, I signed about 1,000 audit opinions in my career. The first time I signed an officer certification, I really worried. It's a different feeling when you're signing your own name. Secondly, that officer certification goes much farther than an audit opinion. And I would encourage the board to take a look at it as a model of what we should ask auditors to be doing, not hiding behind GAAP, looking for fairly stated, unequivocally, addressing fraud, addressing controls. That's all in the officer certification, yet we let the auditors get away with a lot less.
Lynn, you want to have the last word on this panel? I'm sorry, Brandon. I apologize. And Meredith, Barbara. And then we've got until 2:30, so 15 more minutes, and we'll go on to the next one.
My word will be short. It's just to agree with Damon and Calvin that going from partnerships to publicly held companies is fraught with risk and needs to be done very carefully if you were to go that way, for the capital and other reasons that Norman highlighted. There may be reasons to try and expand the scope, but the change from partnership to public company has a cultural implication that I think you can't underestimate. And also to agree with Bob that I think that the signature and the certification process, I had the same experience. Admittedly, it was the difference between signing legal opinions and signing officer certificates. But I do think it's a very real difference.
We certainly appreciate that, or at least I appreciate those comments. I mean, and one of the reasons to have the investor advisory group is to hear directly from investors, because you often don't have the time or the resources to comment on a lot of these issues. And therefore, I think that your views are very important to get on a record. because the overwhelming comment letters on the engagement partner signature were opposed to it, and they came primarily from the profession. And so hearing a number of your views on that is important in terms of creating a record. But moving down the table, Merritt, do you want to go next?
I'm happy to, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Mike lighting the fire. I'll throw the grenade in. And I have to use Mike's word, inherent. I think there is an inherent conflict anytime you have relationships that involve one party paying another for a service, and that service and that relationship is measured in decades, if not centuries. So my thought is you rotate them. You get a five-year deal. If you perform, you throw them out, bring in a new team, throw them out, bring in a new team. I feel very strongly about that. I've practiced that for 20 years with a number of professional service providers, all of them partnership kinds of firms. I'm convinced that every firm providing a professional service, and I don't care if it's a dentist, an actuary, an investment advisor, an accounting firm, has a unique and valued perspective. And if you're not going to rotate, you better bring someone in to look over their shoulder every several years. It keeps everybody on their toes. It's expensive. It's darned expensive. That first year of a five-year accounting deal, it's a killer to the auditee, and it's a killer to the audit firm. They're not making any money. They make out like bandits in the fifth year, no doubt about it. And overall, there's probably some additional cost, but I think there's huge, huge value in having a rotation of those different perspectives. It's a huge value to the auditee, whether it's me as a pension plan, whether it's someone else as a corporate entity. I know it's a wonderful thing for me. I bitch about it, 24/7 when we've got a new auditor in. But you know, when it's over with, after that first year, I can step back and say, you know what, we've been going down this path, and they shed some light on some things that we're doing that makes a lot of sense, and I think we're better because of it. I feel really strongly about that. I know it's very radical, but I think it certainly has worked for us in a number of areas. I think it could work for the corporate world as well. Thanks.
Well, Bonnie, we haven't heard from you, and then we'll go to Damon, then we'll go to Lynn. And Lynn, you're both from Colorado, you and Merritt, so you can talk about the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and rotation of auditors and the political implications of that particular issue. Not that a lot of people would disagree with you, Meredith, but that issue is certainly.
Mr. Chairman,
we'll look forward to the Colorado contingent handling.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not talking about partners.
No, neither were we in terms of the Sarbanes-Oxley, but the two of you can fly home together and think the great thoughts on the way to the Sky High State.
Bonnie Hill. And I was interested in Meredith's comments. One, because when a public company changes auditors, the street says, uh-oh, something's wrong, what's going on? And then, the board is put on the defense again. So I'm not opposed to that idea, but I think it would certainly have to be made very clear that that's the policy of the board. The other thing is, it is pretty disruptive in terms of the work that has to be done within the company and the auditing team and the finance team and all of that. So I really would suggest you look at that a public company, look at it very carefully, because you change the audit partner every 5 years or so, but to change the whole company just because of a policy might not be the best way to go. And I think in terms of the cost to the shareholders and the disruption to the company, have to make sure it's worth it.
Damon Silvers.
The thing about some of these issues is that Steve, as you were alluding to, they all have a certain history to them, and some of them have been, I think, discussed and advocated by investors for so long that some of us begin to forget the list of things we're advocating, perhaps get discouraged. So in my prior comments, I didn't mention these two matters that have since come up that I think are both wise. One I think small and almost trivial, but yet savagely resisted by the audit profession, which is to have the audit partner identify who they are. Something which, I mean, those of us in the legal profession know that, you know, every SEC filing is signed by an attorney, not by a firm, but by a person. And so I don't get it. But that seems like small potatoes compared to Meredith's point, which just reminds me again, going back to, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley and the like, that this was, that firm rotation was and still is, I think, something that investors have advocated for. And I want to go at it from a somewhat different perspective than the ones that Meredith laid out, which I agree with. We have a big problem, and we wrestled with it on the ACAP. It's funny, I can never keep that acronym in its, you know, in my head. When we wrestled with at great length, Bonnie and I in particular, on the competition subcommittee. Of, you know, a market for audit services for large firms, it's extraordinarily concentrated in the Big Four, and which gives rise to the systemic risk issues associated with the potential failure of any one of those firms, and the like. Seems to me that for some of the reasons Bonnie alluded to, in the current regime. For an issuer to change audit firms sends all sorts of signals to the marketplace that nobody wants to send, and then you have to spend a lot of time running around and interpreting what you're doing and the like, and nobody may ever really fully believe you. They'll keep asking, you know, investors and journalists will keep asking, you know, well, tell me really why are you doing this and so forth. And it's not just that leads to the type of sort of embedded relationships that Meredith was talking about. It's that I think it's an obstacle to developing a more competitive market. I think it makes it more difficult for there to be processes and entry points for firms that are aspiring. And we all know what the firms are. There's a couple of firms that potentially could play for the larger, you know, for the larger audit clients. I think it makes it more difficult for those firms to do so. I think it makes it more difficult for anyone thinking about, you know, could you do a roll-up of some kind? Could you put together a viable competitor to think about then, you know, how would you compete? What would you go after? If there was structured rotations without sort of sinister implications, I think it would be a significant piece of encouragement to seeing some improvement on the competitiveness side as well.
Okay, I'll just limit my comments to the last topic that's just been discussed, and I'll probably be maybe in the minority around this table, but having been in the shoes of an auditor, the rotation idea, I do think it's been helpful in terms of rotating partners within firms. I think that for a whole host of reasons, going back to segregation of duties, going back to some things that have been talked around about this table, that it comes down to the quality of the audit partner, you know, very often to put it all together. The challenge, because I definitely agree we could get more independent audits by rotating firms, and then you'd get the ultimate independence. But I'm not sure with large global enterprises, particularly the most complex beasts that we've been talking about today, the list that Lynn went down of effectively failed enterprises through the last crisis, for a firm to come in and get up to speed, particularly given the fact that we're in a constant reporting cycle, so we don't stop the mill, quarters are going out, you know, while the new audit firm's coming in, getting up to speed. I think we're going to go that route as a country and an economy, that we'd want to be very, very thoughtful about how we did it and how we deal with the transitions and so forth. Not saying, again, there's a right or wrong answer, but it just, I'd slow us down a little bit in terms of just how hard it is to get up to speed on these things. And the fact that at the end of the day, you want one person, everybody wants one person to sign the audit opinion. For one person to get up to speed on General Motors or on J.P. Morgan Chase is just a mind-boggling exercise, even with the help of hundreds of people in their firm.
Very briefly, CalPERS is huge, as you all know, $200 billion plus, but is required by law locally to rotate its auditors every 5 years and is not allowed to reappoint the existing firm. It can only give a 5-year contract. So there is some experience in large financial institutions. Maybe we should look at that. The other thing I just wanted to say, as you were asking for comments for the record, that I don't think I said specifically, but CalPERS does support the recommendations in the ACAP report, and I want to highlight the audit engagement partner's signature is something that would certainly add value for this person doing the signing as much as for the readers of the accounts.
Three things, Steve. First of all, the issue of capital and only four firms. About 10 to 12 years ago, the profession looked at alternative firm structures. Some firms adopted them, but quite frankly, they never worked out for any of the firms. And some of the firms now regret having gone into those structures. If you look at the size of the regional firms, again, if you go and look at the number of offices, number of people, the capital in them, there is no way possible for any of those to grow up into another Big Four. So we are stuck with the too few to fail. That's the reality of it. There's nothing you can do. So to do this, to say we're going to raise capital, create competition, is a gross misnomer. It will never happen. It can't happen. We've let it get so dominated by this oligarchy that we're stuck with it for this point in time until someone has got the guts, quite frankly, to go do a breakup. And that's and even then, the firms don't generate the type of rate of return that you'd expect in a public company. So they couldn't raise the public capital because, quite frankly, they aren't going to generate the type of returns you'd really want to see there to start with. That's the first point. Second point, someone raised the question about can you really get information out of the financials of these? The answer is yes. You can see what liquidity is looking like in these firms and cash flows. You can look at what their calls on their cash is and what they're having to use the cash up for, including the revolver. You can turn around and, most importantly, look and see what they're spending on and investing in two key components, one technology and one people. If you ever manage one of these units, and I did manage them inside the firm, there are very key components as far as what you're spending on people out of every revenue dollar, what you're generating in revenue dollar per people. It tells you how much you're leveraging up the people. It tells you whether or not you're putting your money where you need to make sure that you're getting the job done right. That information is available in those financials and only available in those financials, so it's very important you get that. On the last point, rotation. It did used to be that there was a negative connotation with changing auditors, but in the last half dozen years, thousands of companies have changed auditors, and that's no longer the case. Analysts have gotten so used to seeing a change in auditor, it's a natural, they ask a question about it, you tell them, and it's over. It doesn't have the negative connotation, nothing close to what it used to. And if you go to a mandatory rotation, say like every 10 years, then in fact, everyone knows what it is. So that argument is set aside. Furthermore, it's extremely expensive for the firms to rotate the audit partner every 5 years, especially on the big companies, because you got these partners you have to move around all the time and stage them, so it becomes very expensive for the firms. And quite frankly, I've never seen one of those partners stand up and say, let's change our financial statements from what we were doing as a firm before, because they know that that results in litigation and a suit. So I don't think you get a whole lot on partner rotation. So I am a strong supporter of what Damon says in terms of mandatory rotation. There was a recent excellent article in CFO Magazine where a number of CFOs talked about how they were changing auditors and changing to get lower fees. And what was interesting in the article is not one of them, while they all talked about how great a job they'd done, and Bonnie, it was how great a job the CFO was doing, not the audit committee, in getting those lower fees, okay? Not a single one of them turned around and complained about the cost of changing auditors. Not a single one of them.
What you haven't addressed, though, and what hasn't been addressed, is the whole issue of competition with mega organizations. You know, if you've been through an auditor or two and the one left has your competitor, not going there. There's no confidence.
Yeah, I chaired
that's something that has to
I be chaired a Fortune 200, Fortune 150 size company's audit committee, and you always just make sure you keep one clean, and you can do it.
Keep one clean, yeah.
Keep one clean.
Well, I think now we'd like to turn to the next panel, which is the greater transparency of the audit process. And Bill, I'd like to turn that over to you.
Thank you, Steve. We've been talking about audit firms and now want to shift to talking about the audit process. Really, I think it's a matter that has been discussed quite a bit today, but the objective of this next panel perhaps is to put a little extra focus on the audit process by pulling back the veil, if you will, and trying to more specifically identify what should be disclosed and who should disclose it, and more specifically, what is the role of the PCAOB in that disclosure. Our designated hitters to get us started are Kelvin Blake, Norman Harrison, and Bonnie Hill, and the first up to bat is Kelvin.
Thank you. Given the limited time we have here, I wanted to focus my comments on achieving greater transparency in the auditor's report. I'll then turn it over to Bonnie and Norman to share their comments. The current auditor's report is not very transparent and provides the financial statement user with very little information into the audit process and the underlying financial statements. The current reporting model has been in existence since the 1930s with very little change and is considered by many to be a pass-fail model or a boilerplate model. I believe that the standard report should be changed to provide greater transparency to the investing public. I believe the report should be revised in two ways. One, I think the report needs to be expanded to include informative disclosures relating to both the auditor's responsibilities and the audit process itself. Second, I believe the report should be written in more plain English. I've shared the auditor's report with some of my colleagues who are actually attorneys, and they have a difficult time understanding what the report is actually saying. First, I think that the auditor's report should be expanded to include a discussion of the auditor's responsibilities regarding detecting fraud during the audit process and the limitations that the auditor faces in detecting fraud. I believe a big part of the expectations gap that exists between the financial statement users and the auditing profession comes from the fact that the users believe that the auditors should be detecting all types of fraud, whereas it's clear from the under the current standards, auditors are responsible for searching for fraud, but they're not necessarily going to find that fraud because a lot of fraud is basically caused by management acting in collusion and is hidden from the auditors. I also believe that the auditor's report should be expanded to include a discussion of the materiality issues that auditors face and both the qualitative and quantitative issues that the auditors face when conducting audits. Materiality is determined by what an auditor believes would have changed or influenced the judgment of a reasonable financial statement user. Given that the auditor is relying upon what he or she believes a reasonable financial statement users would determine to be material, I think that should be disclosed to the financial statement user. I think the report should discuss generally the qualitative factors that are considered in an audit and for the particular audit in question, the existence or the absence of such factors. In addition, the auditor's report should discuss the quantitative materiality levels set by the auditor and used in planning evidence accumulation and in determining whether the financial statements as a whole are materially misstated. What basis did the auditor use in determining materiality, net income before taxes, total assets? What percentage of the basis was determined to be material? 5% of net income before taxes? 10%? For comparability purposes, I believe it is relevant whether the auditor set materiality at 4% of NIBT, net income before taxes, versus 6%. Finally, I believe the PCLB should consider expanding the auditor's report to include a discussion of the significant accounting principles used by management, significant estimates made by management, and the key risk factor areas identified by the auditors. While some of this information may be in fact disclosed in the financial statement notes, I believe it's often overlooked by the investor. And finally, I want to discuss plain English. Regardless of whether the auditor's report is expanded to include the disclosures that I've just mentioned, I think the report needs to be written in plain English. Currently, the report uses a lot of accounting terminology that is not easily understood by the non-accountants. I would imagine that the average investor does not know what it means for an auditor to plan and perform the audit to obtain reasonable assurance about whether the financial statements are free of material misstatements. For example, is it clear to the average investor that reasonable assurance does not mean that the auditor is not guaranteeing the financial statements are without material misstatement? Does the reasonable assurance terminology provide the financial statement user with the level of assuredness provided by the audit? Does the average investor know what constitutes a material misstatement, or that materiality is determined based upon the auditor's perception of what the reasonable investor would find material? Is it clear to the average investor that examining on a test basis means that the auditor is testing only a sampling of the transactions and then projecting that sampling onto the entire class of transactions or the account balance? Thank you.
I think I'm next, Steve. This is Norman Harrison. Kelvin's done a very good job of laying out the framework. I'll just expand on a couple of points, and then I'm going to take the liberty of pulling forward the independence issue, which we touched on in the last panel, but I think it has some relevance here that I'd like to include in the discussion. You know, we perhaps overly glorify the end product of the auditor's work by calling it a report. It is, in effect, a letter. I was reminiscing with some colleagues at dinner last night that, you know, way back when I was an undergraduate in business school and then went through my first job in New York as a young analyst and began to study financial statements and then went to law school and learned about due diligence. You know, back in those days, it was customarily a three-paragraph letter, and if you got to the 10-K or got to the annual report and you opened got to the page and it was a three-paragraph letter, you just turned the page and kept reading, because only if there was a fourth paragraph or some additional language in there you didn't expect to see did you stop and actually, did the red light go off and did you stop and read it. We haven't advanced very much since then. It's still a highly formulaic report, a lot of boilerplate language, as Kelvin noted. And I think that when the investor community thinks about what would be beneficial in terms of greater disclosure around the process of conducting the audit, we mean a real report, an actual narrative description of the approach that the firm took to this particular engagement for this particular year. How was it staffed? What were the resources the firm deemed necessary to contribute to the team? What was the audit plan? What framework did they follow in conducting the audit? What technical expertise or subject matter experts within the firm, not necessarily by name, but by function, did they draw upon and why? And I think perhaps most importantly, to tie into to Kelvin's comments, a discussion of the principal financial risks that the company faces and which the auditors took into account in designing their audit plan and, importantly, in developing their measures or standards of materiality, because risk and materiality are hand in hand, and I think a well-crafted audit report would describe both of those at an appropriate level of detail and explain how they interconnected in terms of the actual conduct of the audit. Another area where I think it would be helpful to have more disclosure, we've talked in other contexts today about the on-off switch or the toggle switch nature of a lot of what the auditors render an opinion on. in connection both with financial risk and with the connection with the evaluation of internal control processes, even in those situations in which no material weakness is found to exist, I think it would be very helpful from an investor standpoint to have some narrative discussion of issues that were identified, or perhaps emerging trends or emerging areas of concern that, while still short of a material weakness, may be headed in that direction and may require some attention on the part of the issuer. And I think knowing that the auditor identifies those and disclosed those or urged management to pay attention to those would be something that the investors and capital markets would be well served by understanding. I think also in the current environment, given in particular the events of the past 2 years, I think some discussion and disclosure of the degree of regulatory risk an enterprise faces would be a very helpful addition to an auditor's report. And then lastly, a word on independence, because it is certainly a governance issue, but the independence determination is essential to the conduct of the audit, because it is the threshold decision to be made at the outset as to whether or not the firm is actually competent to conduct the audit for the year in question. I think that it would be extremely useful, and you know, we are again in an environment in which audit firms are providing a wide array of services to their clients. Everyone is back in the consulting business through the advisory practices. Many cases are providers of significant amounts of tax service to their clients. We have the benefit of bodies of rules and regulations, most importantly through the PCAOB, but in addition through the SEC, that we didn't have the last round of financial fraud. I think the next logical step here is to require disclosure to investors of the process by which the independence determination was made, because I think we're back in an environment where there certainly are, in many instances, some close calls. And it would be helpful to know, to have a description of the firm's internal engagement acceptance process with respect to the specific engagement in question, the steps the firm took to measure and determine its independence, and importantly, discussion of any issues that came up, both internally as the firm vetted the engagement, and perhaps even more importantly, in discussions with the audit committee. What questions were raised, what potential compromises to independence were identified, and on what factual basis were they resolved. And I think that would also, Steve and other members of the board, I think that would be important information to better inform your inspection process as you go in and examine, you know, independence processes that the firm is following. So those are my highlights or seeds to sow for further discussion, and with that I'll turn it over to Bonnie, who will provide the customer, the client's perspective.
Okay, Bonnie Hill here. My colleagues have said it all. I'm neither an accountant nor a lawyer, and I'm not going to try to be either. And so when I started looking at the topics that we had on hand, my first question was, who cares and why do they care? Why does it matter? And what's my role in all of this? And why do I need to know it? And I thought about the fact that, you know, when we look at shareholders and what they come into in terms of their investments, it's that they want to know, one, whether it's worth their putting their monies into a particular organization, if that organization is well run. Is this a good investment for me? Are the financial statements clean? Who's overseeing the process? How are they doing it? And so those are the things that matter, and it matters to shareholders. When we talk about shareholders, we have people here representing sort of large investors, and yet and still we talk about, you know, more transparency, greater disclosure, and sometimes what that means is much more paper, more legal jargon, and more accounting jargon. And so the average investor, the mom and pop who puts their money into an organization, can't begin to make anything out of all those disclosures. So when we make the disclosures, when we talk about plain English, does that mean more is better? And I think not. I think it means that perhaps we have two different audiences, and we have the financial markets that need to see one thing and need a great deal of disclosure and insight, and then we have the sort of small investor who really wants to understand what it is he or she is reading. And so the plain English to me goes to the sort of smaller investor because those of you here and around the table, you don't need a lot of plain English. You know exactly what you're reading. You've already demonstrated that, you know, in discussions around the table. So so it becomes a question of how do we disclose the information that needs to be there. As a director, you know, and the one for which the blame goes to when something isn't disclosed in which people, in the way people think it should be, then I do want to know. I do want to question, particularly in the boardroom, how the auditors have gotten to where they got. What have they seen that they won't disclose to me as a director? I want to know how to get to that, and I want to know the process that they use. And it's very interesting. I think last night, or with our group, our team, I was saying that, you know, when I was on audit committees, the question I would ask at the end of the meetings is, okay, what would you have asked if you were sitting in my seat that I have not thought to ask, or any of us have not thought to ask? And the amazing thing is that on more than one occasion, we had an auditor to say, well, I think I would want to know. And I'm, you know, my question was, why didn't that come out without me asking the stupid question? And it's probably, I won't speculate, but I will speculate, because a lot of times people don't want to come out. They don't know if a director really wants to know the good, the bad, and the dirty. And so I think there are times when the director in the boardroom really has to push the auditor and make certain that the auditor has the comfort level in terms of saying what he or she sees. And then in terms of transparency, I think definitely that in our annual reports, an overview of how the auditor has proceeded with his or her work is important, and how the board uses that. But I think if it can be done concisely and in a readable fashion for the average person, that would make a tremendous difference. And we sort of joked last evening about the fact that maybe what we're looking at are two annual reports, two sets of disclosures, one for the average person like me and one for all the really smart people like you guys. And that's, I think with that, I wanted to save us some time, and I didn't really have a lot to say so that we could have a discussion.
Over to Marty, he's done a lot of work in the standards in this area. I know, Gus, you know, you indicated this was a priority, and you had some comments, and I'd like to, because we are, to a certain extent, we are creating a record here, I'd like you to give us, you know, the comments that you had. And then, Pete, you also mentioned it as a priority, and I'd like to get your comments and any others as well. You know, in the SAG, we've got some of the comments of the other members who are here, but we would welcome others. But Gus, since we haven't heard from you before on this issue, and Pete, since we haven't heard before from you on this issue, why don't we do that now? And then since Marty and the standards has been doing a lot of work and has vetted this issue a little bit, I'd like to turn it over to him.
Great. Thanks, Steve. This is Gus Sauter speaking. There are two items that I'd like to talk about. The first one is what I'll call the distance from the cliff. It seems like the audit is, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay, oops, it's a qualified opinion. And there's really not much of an indication of how close to the edge of the cliff you are all along the process. And clearly, of the audits that are clean, quote-unquote clean, there have to be differences. There has to be a range, and so we think that there should be some comment within the audit letter as to things that should be considered. It could be in the form of a checklist that's perhaps presented in an appendix. Things like the types of modeling that were done to determine the value of assets. You know, perhaps a listing of contingent liabilities. So there was discussion earlier about SPVs, and here I'm a little bit torn between what's the domain of FASB versus the PCOB, but if the auditors could say, we think that there's risk here with contingent liabilities or SPVs, that would be very helpful. So, again, just perhaps a checklist or some indication as to how close a firm might be from a qualified opinion as opposed to just pass-fail. Another point, a little bit different slant from some of the other comments, as opposed to the financial risk of a firm or the investment risk of a firm, I think we would appreciate discussion as to the risk of the audit itself. So there, certainly within an audit, there are many things that are identified that are not risky. I mean, you know for certain what they are. Cash, you know what cash is. But then there are other items, items that might involve fair value accounting, where there's a wide range of potential estimation error. And what we need as analyzers of the financial statements is some help trying to figure out where we should focus the bulk of our time. We need to know that a certain method was used to estimate values of certain types of assets and focus on those so we're not wasting time on the straightforward issues. Fair value accounting is obviously fraught with estimation error. As I mentioned earlier when we were talking about the fraud center, on average, the financial statements can depict the financial value of a firm, but there's risk around that average, and we need to know where those areas are. So help within the audit report as to where to go to find to focus on those risks would be beneficial.